You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 1st of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One at Midori House with me, Robert Bounds, and Hugo McDonald.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll be cruising the piazzas and palazzos at Venice with Times critic Rachel Campbell-Johnston to get her take on this year's Art Biennale.
We'll also be meeting Dan Beaumont, the man many credit with making Dalston in East London the capital's hippest night spot.
And we'll tell you how to spend a great weekend in Barcelona.
The beginning of June heralds a jam-packed cultural calendar for the self-proclaimed Mediterranean capital, Barcelona.
Plus, it's theatre boom time in London at the moment. The IHT's Matt Wolf will be here to tell us why.
So, lots to look forward to this week on The Review, here on Monocle 24.
And we're coming fresh at you from Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Robert Bound. I'm with Hugo McDonald.
Hello, Rob.
I've got two words to describe already the first 2 seconds of today's programme. What do you think those two words are?
Barcelona?
Dream team. Oh, Barcelona. I like that in the menu section of the show, which we just, the hurdle that we just jumped over.
I just wanted to flex my Catalan tongue a little bit.
Barcelona. And then a man in the clip basically corrected you.
I know. I think maybe he was going for the more global pronunciation, whereas I like to keep it local.
I like that. I thought it was the other way around. I thought Madrid was like the th and Barcelona was the s. I thought that was their thing. They were kind of like, we're not Spanish, we're Catalan, and we don't do the th. We do this.
I've been getting it wrong all these years.
Anyone listening to this just is basically going to think it's like a CD skipping us talking. And get Dan Beaumont's coming in later. He knows all about and boo, 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 right?
So he does indeed.
We're basically warming up for him.
Exactly. And I can't wait to hear what Dan Beaumont has to say, because as we said at the beginning of the show, he has really been credited with the East End, I was going to say revival, but it's not so much a revival as an explosion.
Sort of pulling it up by its bootstraps, right?
Indeed. The nightlife that both you and I have sampled maybe once or twice.
Now there's a man that owes me about 100 drinks. He probably is a millionaire because of us. I'm kind of coming in rags.
Exactly. Well, maybe he's going to come in with a reward for all the money that we have spent at his various night spots in the East End of London.
Maybe he's got like a trophy.
Quite possibly.
You know, like when you're good at cricket or you're good at snooker or anything like that, even a most pedestrian sport like darts, you kind of get a big trophy and it's kind of maybe got a picture of the person doing the sport. What would be the trophy for the Dalston Superstore? Dancing or drinking? What would a little silver man be doing?
A shot at the bar? Or queuing to get in, actually, possibly.
Probably queuing to get in the rain.
Exactly.
And ruining your hair.
Really wondering if it's worth it. But Rob, tonight you won't be in the East End of London. You're going to see...
I'm going to be in the West... Southwest of them.
Exactly. You're going to see Beyonce, which
so this is a big charity gig.
Indeed. Not just Beyonce, J-Lo too, I hear.
It's Jay-Z, J-Lo, I can't think of any, J-Cloth.
Wearing J-Crew.
Oh man, I love that. This is what we're talking about. This is the kind of thing I want. Riffing. Beyonce, John Legend, there's a J, J-Ledge.
J-Ledge.
There we go. This is a breast cancer charity thing tonight, which is rocking at Twickenham. Frankly, I'm very excited about it. Frankly, I'm already stressed about how to get home.
Yes.
I don't know why, you know, that's what's happened to me. I think it's kind of like one of those, oh my God, it's going to be amazing. I can't wait for this to happen. Well, I'll tell you what, shall I order Madison Lee?
Is it called old age?
It's called old age.
Are you going to be waiting?
You're just looking at me and deciding that it's something to do with old age.
Well, I'm going to be having a very sensible dinner on the other side of London, around the corner from where I live. Okay. No worries about where I'm going home or how to get home. But I wish you luck.
Well, don't worry. I'll phone you up and I'll just like have an annoying blast of music, and that will be one of those. Oh, it's amazing! It'll be like the beginning of the show where it's all tss and pff, like that. Before we head to our first guest, we've got to very quickly. It's called the review.
Mm.
We got to review the week very very quickly. How's your week? Good. Good for what?
Very good week. It was very very busy week here at Midori House as we sent to print the biggest issue that we have ever done of Monocle, the mammoth July August quality of life issue.
This is the one that comes with a kind of huge Volvo Pantechnicon to bring it to people when they buy it.
Yes, it does. I mean, people have been building up their biceps in anticipation of receiving this magazine. It is the thickest, the heaviest, the most jam-packed edition of Monocle that we have ever done.
It's a rocking thing.
Definitely.
This week it's been a good week for, I hope it's been a good week for radio. It's been a very busy week, I think. Bad week for my hair. I thought my hair was looking great this week. I hate wearing headphones. I'm going to get earphones in the studio.
Oh, Rob, you're so precious.
I know, look at it. Can you smell this bit of hairspray on there?
No, I can't smell the hairspray yet.
No one wants to know this.
No.
It's Saturday morning here in London. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about the Venice Biennale. We're coming to you live from Studio One. It's The Review. And over in Venice, the quiet lapping of the Adriatic and the gentle crooning of gondoliers has been joined this week by the cacophony of the art world. The vernissage of the 55th Venice Art Biennale kicked off. The event itself opens to the public next week.
The Biennale hardly needs introduction. It's the biggest, oldest, most international showcase for art in the world. And though the main action is divided between the former shipyards of the Arsenale and the leafy national pavilions in the Giardini, it's very much a citywide affair.
Rachel Campbell-Johnson is chief art critic for The Times here in London and has been covering the Biennale for years, and she joins us on the line now to talk us through the highs and lows of the 55th edition. Rachel, welcome to The Review.
Hello.
Now, this week, I gather this was more of a waders and galoshes event than the kind of normal sunscreen-friendly event that it normally is, right? Were you splashing through Venice?
Well, actually, it wasn't too bad by the time I got there. It was just overcast. There was a sort of Tupperware sky, as if one of those Tupperware lunchboxes had been put over the city. But luckily, it wasn't flooded.
And, Rachel, has it been a good Biennale? Is it sort of facile to say good or bad? Or is that really the whole reason for the vernissage, that people go see as much as possible and then form an opinion based on that?
Well, actually, do you know what? I think it's been the best Biennale for at least a decade, if not longer. And that was quite reflected by everyone else. Everyone seemed very up on it, which was an irony because it was actually one of the quietest ones I've been to. There were all those sort of big dealers who normally sort of set up home in Cipriani or, you know, wherever, one of the smart hotels, the Danieli or something. They just jetted in and out for the day, targeted a few shows and went. I hardly saw a sort of A-lister from Hollywood or a celebrity on the street. So it was a very quiet one, and you might have thought that was because people were losing interest, but it's actually more focused. And actually, do you know what the real message is? I thought was that the outsider was being invited in. That seemed to me the underlying message. I mean, there's this huge brain-addling, eye-fuddling, foot-bruising art bino which takes place, and often it can feel terribly exclusive. It's certainly a pretty daunting experience to go there, not just in the sort of hectic run-up, but right through. It was as big as ever. There were 10 new participants being added to the list of contributing nations. But the sheer range of artworks on show, that was vast as ever. But I think what made it different was that they orchestrated it in such a way that you didn't need to be an art expert to come to terms with it. And they made this very clear. The theme was the Encyclopedic Palace, which is taken from a work by a self-taught Italian-American called Marino Auriti. And no, I hadn't ever heard of him either. But apparently he passed years of his life brooding on the building of a museum that would house all the world's knowledge. And an architectural model of this planned building, a sort of Tower of Babel, opens the Arsenale exhibition, which is the main sort of curated show, which sets out the fashions, the tastes, what we're going to be looking at. And inside, beyond, it was like a cabinet of curiosities. 30% probably of the artists were actually dead. They were sort of old works. And there was anything from those ex-photos, you know, those sort of bits of limbs and breasts that people hang up in Italian churches to ask God to bless them, to works by prisoners, to works by mad people who were doing it as therapy. There were blind people sort of drawing a world they could never see. So there was all this work of outsider artists, and that's clearly the great new fashion. But as well as inviting these outsiders in, they invited us in, us the spectator, in that you didn't need to grab your art historical textbook and try and think, oh my God, what the hell is this about? You could engage with it very directly. And it's interesting too to see work by these outsiders put completely and hung on a par with some of the most famous names in the art world.
And is this one of the strengths of the Biennale, I guess, is that I guess people are obviously aware of the fact that these are national, that in the Giardini as opposed to the Arsenale, these are national pavilions, Rachel. Which countries sort of most obviously wrestled with the reputation of having to display art that had a big sign over it saying UK or France or Israel?
Well, probably actually the UK was the one with the biggest sign. Jeremy Deller did something called English Magic.
It's Great Britain, isn't it? It's very old school, in fact.
It would have actually baffled anyone who wasn't English. You know, anything from sort of the Standing Stones at Avebury to Ziggy Stardust's 1972 tour, with all sorts of pictures that, if you're as old as I am, you'll remember from your youth, sort of pictures from, oh, I don't know, the IRA troubles and, Idi Amin's Indians landing in London, having been evicted from the country. But what on earth foreigners made of it, I don't know. Quite apart from the fact that halfway through there was a sort of cup of tea being offered, and I have to say it rather short up every cliche. The English can't even, or the British can't even get to a five-room pavilion without stopping off for a cuppa on the way.
And it's a tea pavilion, isn't it? I think originally the British pavilion at the Giardini it's an old tea house, isn't it? That's the architectural riff that it's doing.
Yes, there is. There's that sort of sense of a colonial tea house, yes.
Rachel, you mentioned earlier that there were 10 new participating countries. Any standouts from this new band?
Well, I thought that the standout was actually the Holy See, the Vatican, for the first time representing itself. And basically, it was inviting you to play God. It's quite hard to describe, but it was basically an immersive video installation which took the first book of Genesis as its focus. And you stretched out a hand, a bit like the divinity in Michelangelo's Sistine fresco, and you touched one of the screens on which people were moving about. And the people moving about turned out to be deaf mutes who, when you touched them, would step forwards and describe with their hands the creation of a flower or a plant or an animal, which then went into the mix of some sort of cosmic whirl in the middle. So it was very, very... Sorry, my daughter has just walked in. So it was this incredibly immersive and very generalized piece. There was no dogma. There was no Roman Catholic dogma being stuffed down your throat. This was very much a sort of Pope Francis type message, even though I wasn't actually Pope Francis who thought of it because he came in too recently. But it was definitely an ecological message.
Very interesting indeed.
I love the idea of the Catholic Church inviting you to play God. I think that's interesting. my, how they've grown. I wanted to ask you about some of the sideshows, Rachel. Obviously, the Arsenale is it's the curatorial side to the Giardini.
Yeah.
But also, there's so much other stuff going on there. There's a lot of sort of brands are kind of using it as a platform to launch themselves or define themselves in a different way. And there's a couple of other things. There was a Peckham Pavilion. There was James Brett's Palazzo di Everything. Axel Weervoort, the Dutch art collector, always does an amazing show at the Palazzo Fortuny. What were some of the, we call them sideshows, but they're often more interesting maybe than the main thing. What were some of those things that stood out for you?
Well, actually, the one that got to me was Welcome to Iraq. At the last Biennale, Iraq introduced itself to artists of the diaspora, but this is the second time. It's actually made visitors engage with artworks being made in the country. And the one which particularly struck me was by an artist who was called Jamal Penjweni. And he filmed the desperate plight of alcohol smugglers on the borderlands. And what really struck me was when I sat down to talk to him, I asked him the first question, how old are you? And the answer was, I don't know. My parents never registered my birth. He was born and brought up as a shepherd. And he had picked up the camera, actually, as a response to the war when he had been asked, invited by the international media to participate in sort of trying to get pictures for them. And he then moved on to be an artist. And it was really evocative, all the pieces talking very much about the situation in Iraq, and actually rather hauntingly by artists who never meet each other because it's too dangerous to travel, perhaps because people don't dare trust each other in Iraq, but it was a very moving pavilion.
Rachel, before we let you go,
yeah?
You mentioned that collectors had sort of been zooming in and being quite targeted and then zooming back out again. But is the business of the Biennale alive and well, do you think? Or does the quietness that you talk about refer to maybe quietness of a business too?
No, I think the art market, the contemporary art market, is still strong. I think because people are being more selective, because I think what used to happen is every sort of lookalike, so you have the great, sort of the big creator who makes something, you know, maybe the Britpack or something like that, a clear brand aesthetic, and then all sorts of people would kind of come in, the liggers would come in and make something that looked quite like it. And at a certain time, at the real sort of hype of the late 80s and 90s, people were snapping up absolutely everything. It doesn't matter if it was a real thing, as long as it looked vaguely like it, they were buying. And I think that has gone. So people are only targeting what they think is the very best.
Right, well, Rachel, we'll let you kind of wash off your wellies, I guess. And I guess it takes such a while for all the stuff that you've seen to sink in for the time being. Rachel Campbell-Johnson from The Time, thank you so much for joining us here on The Review. If you're heading to Venice this year, you'll be able to visit the Biennale for yourself until the 24th of November. And if you tune into my show at 1900 hours on Monday, I like that.
I know, you've put in a very nice little plug.
A little plug for myself.
Culture, right? With Robert Bounds.
Yeah, and Kim Bradley, our Berlin correspondent, who's also a bit of an art spy. She'll be delivering a rather colourful report from this year's event.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Up next is our weekly cultural hop, skip and jump around the globe. Stay tuned.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavours on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are two-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn on film on monocle.com.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
Well, I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
All right, and you're back with The Review at 12:20. We're coming to you live from Studio One here in Midori House. I'm Robert Bound, I'm with Hugo MacDonald. I like listening to the promos. Like, we get played in, and sometimes they're a bit annoying. You know, you're kind of like, you're playing records, and you're like, oh man, I don't want to. It's boring, I mean, that. Annoying. But it's funny knowing the people that do the voices for them. Tom Morris there was the first person.
Okay. Indeed.
Friend of ours. And he's talking, what on earth was he talking about with tomatoes? I was looking at something on the internet, and I put my headphones back on, and he's kind of going, or you can pick some artisan tomatoes.
He's promoting the latest film, no, showing on monocle.com by our wonderful broadcast producer, Gillian Tobias, who borrows various voices from the building to add a bit of colour.
And Thomas has got a good voice. The last person now in that promo was Josh, who sounds essentially like he's kind of auditioning to be James Bond.
Yes.
Right?
He's got quite a good voice.
Very smooth.
But one of my favourite voices we're about to hear.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's all right. We're hurrying out. We're jumping over the hedges.
Yes.
In this grand national of a radio show. It's going to be fine. I'm Robert Bound. I'm with Hugo MacDonald here. Now it's time now to cross to our associate editor, Nelly Gotcheva, to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
In Brussels, catch the opening weekend of British photographer Martin Parr's exhibit in Gallery Paris-Beijing. Through his six major series, Common Sense, Last Resort, Small World, Luxury, Bored Couples and Life's a Beach, Parr explores the themes of globalization and its effects on contemporary society. The show is on until the 27th of July. This weekend, the Istanbul Modern Museum presents nearly 300 works by Turkish painter Erol Akıyavaş. The exhibition follows the painter's five-decade-long career, and it is on until the 25th of August. And if you are in Venice this weekend for the Biennale, stop by Gervasutti Foundation. London-based American artist Whitney McVeigh has set up her solo project there, entitled Hunting Song. Set up as an old curiosity shop, It contains a diverse collection of personal objects that McVeigh collected during her various travels. Whitney McVeigh Hunting Song is on until the 7th of July. In Beijing, don't miss the last opportunity to see Pierre Colabov and his exhibition Enigma in its final weekend at the Yan Space Gallery. The videos are influenced by drawing, dance and literature and explore the ties between fiction and reality. For more information, go to yanspace.cn. And this weekend we'll be listening to Iron and Wine, who is touring Europe with his latest album, Ghost on Ghost. For dates and details, go to ironandwine.com. And now let's hear Caught in the Briars. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Back alley's full of rain and everything shining. As holy as she can be, the tricks and the timing. Free as a morning bird, fragile as China. She's stuck in the weakest heart of South Carolina, where all of the naked boys lay down beside her. Sing her the saddest song, all caught in the briars.
And that was Caught in the Briars by Iron and Wine, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
And I'm just turning my pages over. I'm taking it easy.
Well done, Rob.
It's kind of like listening to the sports report where you can hear them rustling their paper. It is time now, of course, for our weekly music review. And today we're staying here in London to meet a man who's helped transform the culture at one end of the city. Seemingly from nowhere, East London is now the epicentre of London's nightlife. And our next guest has played no small part in making that happen.
Dan Beaumont is the man behind three of the names synonymous with the revival of Dalston in East London. Dalston Superstore, Basement Club, The Dance Tunnel, and now the New York-style pizza joint Voodoo Ray. Dan also manages to find time to DJ all over the world and produce underground house music as part of the Jam Factory. Dan, welcome to the review.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We have a very international audience, and although I find it hard to believe that not everybody will have heard of Dalston, maybe you could start just by explaining what it is that goes on there that you've tapped into or maybe helped grow.
Well, I mean, Dalston's actually had a very long history of a very vibrant nightlife and sort of multicultural, very sort of diverse community. And we're really just the latest face of that. We opened Dalston Superstore 4 years ago and just by luck happened to coincide with a huge amount of sort of regeneration in the area it being the kind of hottest postcode for a couple of weeks or something and appearing in the Guardian or I don't know, but it's just good timing on our part, luck I think basically.
And Dalston Superstore a few years on still going strong. I was there myself last Saturday.
Excellent.
We were saying actually Dan probably owes us about £1 million worth of drinks. We expect a trophy, like an old man's pub. We expect our own pewter tanker behind the bar.
Indeed. Your latest venture, Pizza Slices.
Yes.
The idea for that was what?
We'd sort of been exposed quite a lot to Dalston's nightlife, and we kind of thought that we could diversify the sort of...
Move it on from the kebab.
The eating options late at night. The kebabs are actually amazing, it was from loving the pizza slice culture in New York. We were just shocked that it hadn't reached London. This is a couple of years ago now that the idea sort of started forming. And there we are, basically, 6 months later, I think.
I met some girl in the pub the other night with pink hair who works at the Voodoo Ray.
yeah.
What's her name? I can't remember.
Ella.
I've got a picture on my phone.
Yeah, she's our manager.
I expect everyone listening
all over.
That sounds
very creepy, Rob.
It's not creepy. We hung out. She's a friend of a friend. I'm just saying. I'm just trying to bring... What I'm doing is, no matter where you are in the world, I'm bringing it down to a personal level.
She's pretty unforgettable, so yeah, I can understand.
She's an amusing chick. It's good. And how does that work? Is this, as we said, kind of pizza going from the kebabs to the pizza, is it a matter of like, what sustain you to the evening or what might sober you up at the end of the
Yeah, I mean, we're open during the day, very popular with families and kids. And then and later on throughout the night, and it's sort of a lot of people meet there before going out. A lot of people kind of pop in for a kind of intermediary slice.
An intermediary slice.
Between, I mean, some people come, but like we have like bookend customers who yeah. bookend their night with a slice. You start it off with a slice and end it with a slice, and it's quite funny seeing the kind of change in their sobriety.
This is the thing, right? Yeah, exactly. They end up by spilling the mozzarella.
It's good. I mean, it's a good way to end the night, I think. I think you'll definitely you'll be grateful in the morning.
I wish basically I had a slice of pizza last night.
Well, Dan, have you brought some pizza in? You haven't brought some pizza in, but you have brought some music in. And before we get to the first track, maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about Blorp 93.
This is one of the best records of the year. I'm kind of obsessed with this vein of limited edition, hand-stamped house oddities. And this is a label called Blind Jack's Journey, and it's got a stamp of a dog with an eye patch on it, which I presume is Blind Jack. And I think Gnork.
Yeah, Jack Russell.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that would make sense, actually.
We've done the math.
Amazing.
So you don't have to, listeners.
I've learned something. but yeah, and it's some guy out of Eastern Europe. It's just a strange record label, and it's a sort of weird kind of deep house meets ravey piano breakbeat thing.
Let's freak everyone out. That's
yeah, it. Morning.
Let's listen to a bit of Gnork then by Blorp 93.
That was Gnork by Blorp 93.
Actually, the other way around. It's by Gnork and it's called Blorp 93.
Normally you'd be able to guess, wouldn't you? I mean,
yes.
Imagine if a song was called Rod Stewart and it was by Maggie May. That would be really confusing. But like the other way around.
Well, both lovely words, though, aren't they?
Gnork and Blorp 93.
Yeah.
I feel like I've gone, I don't know where I've gone. I feel like it's still last night.
Yeah.
Maybe
I think I played this last night, actually. So I'm sorry, listeners, if that was a bit ravey for your morning.
I think it's a good way to wake up. I think it's a statement of intent there.
Yeah.
So tell us about it. Before we move on to the next track, by the way, I loved that. That was good. But it did make me feel, I had that discombobulated feeling of wandering around Dawson.
Yeah.
Kind of brought it all home.
Almost smell the smoke machine.
Yeah, exactly.
Hunting for pizza.
Yeah, it's dry ice kind of trickling around my feet in this Studio One. Tell us about the DJing. You said you might have dropped the needle on that last night.
Yes.
You travel all over the world. You've got to tell us this. You've got to, in parentheses, you've got to tell us about this thing. This sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, I've been... I started a club night a few years ago, which probably led me on the path that I'm on now, called Disco Bloodbath, which was, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. I'm less involved with that now. Well, not involved with that, really. But that sort of opened a lot of doors, and we were very lucky to be able to go to sort of Japan, Berlin, like the US. And I still, sort of through making records and other avenues, I'm still very fortunate to be able to DJ all over the shop. A lot, predominantly in London at the moment. But still go to sort of New York and San Francisco on occasion.
The number 73 will be your business class flight all over.
Yeah,
all over East London.
Basically,
exactly. Well, and I wonder what the different audiences are like. You mentioned sort of Japan, for example. That's a kind of different culture. Like club culture is a different thing to it, is in London, presumably.
Yeah. I mean, to sort of. Like there's just like in the clubs that we went to and I've played at in Japan, there's just a huge respect for the sort of lineage of dance music.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of your audience knows much more about music than you do, frankly, which is a great challenge.
Guys at the back making notes.
Yeah. Lots of that kind
He's
of
He's playing this.
Yeah.
Let's move on to your next track, Dan. This is Sorcerer by Norma Jean. We'll be right back.
That was Norma Jean with Sorcerer. Before we take all our clothes off, we should talk, we should talk about that one. We were saying, right, that's got to be a Nile Rodgers riff.
Yeah, that's a chic production. And I guess appropriate thing, as we were just talking about, Disco Bloodbath. That's definitely a kind of disco staple of mine.
Is that something where you stick that on? You're kind of like, okay, we need to fuse these elements of the room. We need to get this all going. Is that kind of like a stone cold classic?
Yeah, that never fails. That's in case of emergency, break this record. It's just brilliant. It's a great song, actually, as a lot of, you know, this, and certainly if you've been playing a load of kind of bleepy weirdness like we've had earlier on, it's nice to have an actual song. It's a great, the lyrics are amazing as well. So it's an all round winner.
I like the idea of an emergency, play this record, break the glass on this record. Yeah. Do you have, this is probably a DJ secret, but do you have kind of like maybe five that you know that are kind of like, they're your get out clause?
Yeah, my emergency bombs. Yeah, they're always good. they're always good to deploy. In a basement, a bunker buster, if you will.
A bunker buster. This is what I love. This is the kind of thing, right? This is like sort of, I don't know what's the equivalent of cyanide, the equivalent of like a very strong painkiller the next morning, right? I love the idea of that. I've got an image of you kind of walking around with a kind of very slim record bag with these five records
in
them.
Yeah, that's all I need.
Yeah, it's like a Mission Impossible thing. I like that. That was Norma Jean.
Indeed. And we've got one more track as well. Dan, this is...
I've given you one that's got an accent on it.
Yes, I know, and I'm Control by Mum.
Mum.
Mum. Let's listen to this, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Out the beat. Out. The beat is out. Out the beat. Out. The beat is out. Out the beat. Out. The beat is out. Out the beat. Out. Control. Out. 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 Out.
That was a song about me called Bound. Right? What's wrong with that?
It's not all about you, Rob.
Sorry. I misheard it. That was Control by Mom.
Yeah.
Tell us about that one.
It's just on a brilliant label called Fragile, which I think is French. And it doesn't do much, but it does it very well. Everything in it's just very deliberate. It's just a really nice combination of noises.
It's a very stripped back thing with kind of like a Moroder click on it. Right?
Yeah. It doesn't lend itself particularly well to a kind of 30-second snippet. Actually, I should have thought this through maybe. But it's just a taste of. I mean, I picked it up at Christina Records in Dalston, which is a current obsession of mine. It's just an incredibly, incredibly well stocked. Lovingly stocked.
Until you get in there and clear them out.
Yeah, basically.
So tell us about how do you do this? Are you kind of into buying vintage stuff when you travel? Is that always kind of like
traveling and going to record shops in different towns is brilliant.
Yeah,
and it's a great. You know, there's some amazing like Hard Wax in Berlin and all kinds of, you know, A1 in New York. Amazing discoveries. And again, like Christina in Dalston, it's an amazing example of how something like a record shop can sort of change the whole fabric of the music culture locally, because, you know, everyone's drinking from the same Kool-Aid basically.
And it's a thing, right? It's the taste of the guy that runs the shop.
Yeah.
I guess kind of filters down, and there's only a certain amount of stuff that's available.
Yeah, no, they're very selective, and it's just a great thing to have on our doorstep. And they also sell, you know, vintage disco, post punk, 7 inches, ska, reggae, all, you know, but also, yeah, hand stamped house bangers like that one we just heard.
Hand stamped house bangers, Hugo.
I know, I like
it. You want to get some t-shirts printed with that on?
Yeah.
Just wear them out later.
It goes with my look. Dan, before we let you go, what are you doing tonight? Are you hopping around from venue to venue?
Tonight I'm working at Dance Tunnel. And we've got a DJ called Lawrence who runs a record label called Dial, who is an amazing DJ, and we're very, very lucky to have him. So I'm going to be in Dance Tunnel, which is under Rudy Ray's.
Pizza before or after or both?
Both during, yeah, the whole, it's probably just, I think what one every 90 minutes is the general rationing.
I'm going to learn last night's lesson and get pizzaed up tonight.
Yeah. Get pizza down.
Pizza down. Yeah, that's what I need. I need to be grounded. Do you know what, Dan? I loved having you in today. Thank you so much for coming in and playing your records and telling us about the Dawson Superstore and food and also making me realise I wasn't going mad and I did meet a great girl with pink hair who was Rudy Ray's the other day. Dan Beaumont, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You're listening to The Review live from Studio One here at Midori House, and it's time now to focus in on a city around the globe to hear what's coming up over the coming days. Today, the location is Barcelona, and our man Liam Aldous is here to guide us through it.
The beginning of June heralds a jam-packed cultural calendar for the self-proclaimed Mediterranean capital, Barcelona. But first, we're travelling to Rome. That's because the Barcelona Centre for Contemporary Culture recently inaugurated its exhibition, Travel to Rome with Pier Paolo Pasolini.
Ettore, come corri? A porto bene, che c'è paura?
No, non va piano.
It's a comprehensive panorama of the Italian iconoclast's work in film. Co-produced by four European institutions, the exhibition focuses on Pasolini's love affair with the Italian capital, a sentiment so strong that much of his work transformed the imagery of the city. Having just opened, the retrospective will be on display all summer until the middle of September.
El disseny de Barcelona vol projectar-se al món amb un nou esdeveniment, el Barcelona Design Festival, que neix de la
The city is also gearing up for the third annual Barcelona Design Festival. Opening on the 11th of June, the citywide event begins with Barcelona Design Week, which will showcase its most innovative and interesting design companies, entrepreneurs, and professionals. This is followed by FadFest, which aims to open up the discussion about design with an inspiring series of public forums, conferences, and esteemed prizes. The fostering art and design conversation will continue unabated until the 11th of July. And now to one of Gaudí's most celebrated buildings, La Pedrera. The perfect setting to host an exhibition celebrating the photography of Chema Madoz. A thorough retrospective of his work, Ars Combinatoria brings together more than 70 of his photos from the last three decades. The Spanish photographer is best known for his surrealist black and white portraiture and eccentric interpretations of everyday objects. The absence of digital manipulation is what makes entering into Madoz's world all the more worthwhile. Those daring enough to take the voyage have until July 28th. With summer now upon us, the music festival season is getting into full swing. Each June, Barcelona plays host to the globally revered Sonar Music Festival. A mecca for dedicated festival lovers across the world, this year the premier Advanced Music and Media Arts Festival is celebrating its 20th anniversary. To mark the occasion, Sonar by Day has moved to the Montjuïc Mountain, the first grand event to be held in what will soon become one of Europe's largest cultural and heritage precincts. Some of the headliners include The Pet Shop Boys, Nicolas Jaar, and Sebastian Tellier, just a fraction of the musical artists who will be reverberating across the city on the 13th, 14th, and 15th of June. Spread over 3 days and nights, over 150 artists will join them, belting out their best tunes to help you usher in the warmer months in the best way possible, dancing to your heart's content. For Monocle, in Barcelona, I'm Liam Aldous.
Thank you, Liam Aldous there. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this short break to tell you why it's a great time to go see some theatre in London.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, a show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes. Oh, and the answers are knit, yes, ask the Japanese, San Francisco, where else, the Caracas poor on the up, and a greener than thou Malmo hood. Urbanist listeners, don't look too smug. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Robert Bound.
And we're finishing the show today with a spot of theatre. And today we're focusing on what's in our backyard right here in London. I'm delighted to welcome back regular Review contributor Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, to tell us why London is the place to watch theatre right now. And Matt boasts today one of the sexiest voices in radio.
Well, I have a voice where I would not be able to do two shows today if I were on the West End. But luckily, I should just be able to get about through this session. What's amazing at the moment, Rob, is that there's so much going on in London, that there's always a lot here. But when you think at the moment, there's Tennessee Williams coming up, James Baldwin, the African-American writer, coming to the National, this extraordinary Shakespeare production of Othello at the National, Ibsen transformed at the Young Vic. It's amazing.
So there's some classics. There's obviously some new stuff in there, and there's obviously some stuff that is part of the canon.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about Othello. I was catching.
Yeah, you see, it's very contagious in the studio.
I've got
you better watch out, Hugo.
Better
watch out.
We've got about 13 minutes left to croak our way through London's theatre scene.
We'll just
Paul McCartney's Frog Chorus. If we get into trouble, we'll just play that. We'll just play out with that.
Keep that at the ready.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Othello, how on earth... it's an RSC production, a Royal Shakespeare.
It's a national production.
What's different about this one? I guess it's obviously something that's revived all over the world. There's probably a production of it in play at any moment in time around the world. How are the National making it fresh?
Well, what's great about this production of it, Rob, is it's the first production of Othello I've ever seen where the Othello and the Iago are comparably wonderful. Sometimes you see an Othello where the title character rules Ciutat Legifor a couple of years ago at the Young Vic, for which he won an Olivier, and the Iago was not much. And then you see a brilliant Iago, and the Othello pales into insignificance. Here you've got Adrian Lester as Othello, the wonderful Rory Kinnear as Iago, directed in a contemporary vibe, modern military garb by Nicholas Heitner, who runs the National. Heitner had directed Hamlet prior to this with Rory Kinnear, and Henry V with Adrian Lester. So what he's done is he's brought together two of his previous Shakespeare leading men in one production that is really conversational, colloquial, immediate, visceral, and full of motivation in a play where we're often told there is no motivation. Why does Iago do what he does and bring down the ruin of pretty much everyone in the play, including, of course, himself? And this production has a superabundance of motivation. So actually, it's like watching a freshly minted thriller, even though you've heard the language a million times before.
And Matt, you mentioned there that it has a contemporary setting, which can either work or go spectacularly wrong, but I'm guessing in this case it works very well.
Yeah, it works very well. I mean, we're in a sort of, it's not specifically placed, but it could be, you know, military men in Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever. And of course, Othello is a leader. He is by definition a military man. Iago is part of the sort of military community, but doesn't have his rank. So there are all sorts of issues of status and rank, not to mention sexual jealousy, lust, longing that come into play. Amelia, Yaga's wife, a character who often rises up in productions of the play. She's an amazing supporting character. In this is a female soldier, and that's very interesting. So she and Yaga were in the military encampment together. The one outsider to this world, of course, is Desdemona, Othello's wife, who, of course, is white. He's black. And so that has its own tensions. And it's the last of a triptych that Heitner has done all modern, every single one. And I think in this one it works absolutely the best.
And how explicit, just finally on Othello, how explicit are these references to to the contemporary world that we find ourselves in? How much is it? Is it the costumes that make us kind of lean that way, make us read the play in that way?
Well, the military garb is, it runs rife in the production, and it's got a very sort of, you know, mustardy set by Vicky Mortimer that looks like, you know, a sort of military encampment. Central scenes take place in lavatories and barracks, as opposed to, you know, the Venetian or Cypriot realms of the play itself. But what's interesting is the affect that it gives off. Rory Kinnear, in particular, as Iago, plays him like a guy that you might find who's had a really rough Friday night at the pub in certain parts of the UK, who is ready for revenge. But in this case, it's not, you know, he's going to go and beat up the next person he sees on the street. It's a bit more calculated than that. But that's very much the sort of contemporary vibe that he emits. It's an extraordinary performance. And he's matched every step of the way by Lester as Othello.
That's Othello at the National. Let's come a little bit further south to The Young Vic, where Ibsen's Public Enemy is playing.
Well, this is really brilliant, I think. One of the productions of the year for me. This is Ibsen in 1882 wrote a play called An Enemy of the People. It's one of the sort of defining plays about the irrational tendencies of the masses, in particular, up against the individual. And what David Harrower, who's a contemporary Scottish writer, has done is take Ibsen's 19th century template and transpose it, not exactly to now, not like Othello. It's sort of 1970s, 80s Scandinavia, but it's more modern, of course, than when the play was written. And he has dared to tinker with the meaning of the play so that normally you think with this play, the individual is right and the mob is wrong. Mm. In this production, the mob is probably wrong, but the individual in his righteousness goes mad. So basically, everyone loses. And if you're a bleakaholic as I am, I think there should be awards for, you know, bleakest play of the year and bleakest performance and bleakest worldview. This is pretty stunning stuff because what it says is basically we're all screwed. And if you are the maverick out to transform society, watch out that you don't get carried away by your own tendencies.
This is an interesting thing. What drink do you drink in the interval when it's such a bleak play?
You know what, Rob? There's no interval.
Oh, there's no interval.
And it's 90 minutes straight through. It's a drastically compressed version of the play. And what they do, it's directed by Richard Jones, who never does anything the ordinary way. He does a lot of opera. And, you know, and opera directors are used to tinkering. Mm. And so he brings that tinkering impulse to the landscape of the theater. But what he does is the climax of Ibsen's play, which is kept for this version, is basically a town meeting where the maverick basically has to explain his case that the water system in the community has been contaminated. And obviously, unless that's put right, the community is going to suffer illness or worse, death. So in this case, we, the audience at the Young Vic, become the town hall to whom Dr. Stockman is lecturing. And it's really interesting because he basically turns on the community and becomes a sort of demagogue. And you feel as if while you're watching it, that it's become a play about the birth of almost a kind of fascism.
I'm going to, before we go on to the next thing that you've chosen for us, Matt, I'm just going to leave some radio silence. Or a pin to pause. Okay. That's a great joke, isn't it? Come on, it's Saturday morning. We're allowed
You've
to do
things
like
that. You've been dying to do that,
haven't you? I was thinking about that. I made a face. Matt was looking at me going, why is he making a face? I was thinking of a joke.
Well done, Rob.
So we're going on to The Hot House by Harold Pinter at the Trafalgar, Matt. I did this play when I did theatre studies. I did this for my duologue.
You're kidding.
Yeah,
Were you
Mr. Root and Mr. Lush. I was Mr. Lush. The snow has turned
they
to
came
slush.
The snow has turned to slush, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. How very funny.
It's really strange, even saying that. I don't know,
Rob, that is absolutely bizarre.
So this is one of my favourite plays.
The Snow Has Turned to Slush, which is sort of this...
such a lovely sort of...
It's brilliant. And it's kind of the de facto, de facto mantra of the piece. It's also a play where every character in it, as Rob knows better than I, is wonderfully named because they're all monosyllables. Mm. lush and root and tub and
yes.
miscuts. And there's a character called Lamb who is led quite directly to the slaughter via electrocution. This is the third production of this play I've seen, and in a way it's the least satisfying, but I qualify that. The first production of it I saw, which was in 1990, had Pinter in it.
Yes, and I once, saw that. I went to that.
It was brilliant. Yeah. And he played Colonel Root.
Yeah.
And once you've seen and heard Pinter speak his own language, particularly that part, which is both sinister and funny, terrifying and hilarious.
Like amazingly domineering.
Yeah. And Pinter got it all. And of course, it is osmotic. He knows exactly how to do it because he wrote it, but I don't know that he could explain how he does it. He just does it. Simon Russell Beale plays the part in this production. He's a wonderful actor. He's one of the best Iagos, in fact, in Othello that I've seen prior to Rory Kinnear. But he's not quite, in my view, right for the landscape of this play. He's a little too cuddly and a little too portly, and he does lots of sort of eye-popping theatrics to try to win the audience over. Pinter didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Pinter just stood up ramrod straight, and you were terrified. And you have to believe that the character was a colonel, so has a military past, that he is potentially a murderer, because this is taking place in a mental institution in the late 1950s, and that he's a seducer, because, of course, he's bantering with the one woman in the play, Miss Cutts. He talks a lot about his glory days with women of old. And you don't really believe any of that, particularly with Simon. John Sim is quite good. He's the other main name in the production, playing one of the subordinates in this institution. And the bleakaholics in the audience will have a field day with the electrocution scenes, which are wildly over the top and visceral. And the poor actor, Harry Melling, to whom these electroshocks are administered, practically gets jettisoned into the fifth row.
Oh, God.
I was ready to catch him.
Matt, we've mentioned a couple of times that it's unusually a brilliant amount of theatre on in London. Why is it unusual, and is it just lucky, or is it that there is a wealth of really brilliant sort of directors and actors coming together?
I really think that what has, and as this show knows, I go back and forth to New York, where I'm from, a fair amount, and I'm increasingly aware in New York that unless, and I've said this many times in the show, unless you have Tom Hanks and Bette Midler and people like that, the general audience is priced out of the occasion. Here, that's not the case. You can see Othello for, 10, 15, 20 pounds. You can see Public Enemy for 10. There's an extraordinary show that opened the other day at the Almeida in Islington called Chimerica, which is a three-hour...
This is wonderful, yeah.
It's a three-hour and 10-minute new play by, a young writer, Lucy Kirkwood, directed by a really brilliant young woman director, Lindsay Turner. It's about... Well, half of it takes place in New York, half of it takes place in China, and it is maverick stuff, and I guess the talent is there. They're able to find theaters to put it on, and they're able to get an audience to come see it and that can afford it, and that is the really important thing.
That's a good advert for London theatre. It really is, and Chimerica is one of those things that it's a very hot ticket. That's spitting distance of cars abound as well. We've got to get up there. We've got to finish up there, Matt. And whenever you come on the show, we just get into it.
Yeah, we do.
We hit our stride. Your voice has got better and everything.
You see, maybe I can do the matinee.
Yeah, exactly.
But bring on the dancing girls.
Yeah, exactly. We will see Matt starring in Les Miserables, but that's why he hasn't got a voice. Matt Wolfe from the International Herald Tribune, thank you so much as ever.
And that brings us to the end, sadly, of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
And we've got all sorts of amazing shows on. There's a huge list of them in front of me to read out. I'm just going to say check out The Curator. Join us, of course, all through the weekend for the great music mix and all the shows. I think you're going to use the Google application on your computer. Monocle.com is the place to find everything. For the time being, thank you to all our guests, all the guys behind the glass. Thank you, Hugo. It's a fun show.
Thank you very much, Robert. And thank you all our listeners. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for tuning in.